Good morning. Can you folks back there in the Founders Hall hear me okay? Cool. Thank you. Oh, it's good to see so many people here on a cold January. So this morning, I want to talk to you about a very short verse from Jalaluddin Rumi. A lot of you know Rumi now. He was relatively unheard of a couple decades ago, but now pretty much everybody who's been to Hallmark knows Rumi. It's actually part of a larger poem, but for those of you who are unfamiliar with Jalaluddin Rumi, he's a Sufi poet from the 13th century. He wrote in Persian, and he's kind of widely regarded as one of the great mystic poets, if you know that word, mystic poets of the world. His voice seems to speak to pretty much everybody, regardless of their faith tradition. So if you're a Buddhist, he's a great Buddhist poet. And if you're a Christian, he's a great Christian poet. If you're a Muslim, he's a great Islamic poet. You kind of get the drift. He's just a good poet. And I'm talking about this piece today because this happened to me once before. I spent some time just looking at this poem because I spent some time leading a retreat at the Episcopal House of Prayer. And during those retreats, I share the director's office with the director. And he has some short Rumi verses framed there on his wall. And you know, when you spend 30 seconds reading something, you kind of have a general idea what it's about. Go, cool, that's great. When you spend a half an hour reading the same four lines, all of a sudden something else starts coming out. So I'm buying myself a little insurance by saying everything I'm seeing in this is just, you're getting that from me. How much of this he intended, I don't know. I'm assuming the good stuff he intended and the stuff that doesn't make sense is mine. That's your discernment. The interesting thing is this particular print that's on my friend Ward's wall there, House of Prayer, I gave him this print. He's a huge fan of Rumi. It's one of the things we have in common. And when we lead retreats together and organize things together, we always come back to Rumi as one of our resources. And I gave it to him, and I really liked it. But again, I had done that sort of 30-second reading version of it, going, oh, this is nice. This is nice. There's a niceness to this. I bet he'll like that. And he did. He put it up. But then after sitting there and just staring at it for half an hour because I had nothing else to do, all these other dimensions started coming out. And it's neat. It's neat to read things that way. It's neat to read things that way. I'm of the opinion that if you spent a long enough time with anything, you'd see something. I really do believe that. Like the Dharma, you know, we think of as, oh, yeah, that's the sutras, that's the this, that's the Dogen. Cool, yeah, that's right. But I'm convinced you'd find it. I'm convinced you'd find Dharma in the phone book and the Chinese menu and the dictionary or whatever. You spend a long enough time with something and you start to inhabit it. And, I've heard it said, I actually don't know if this is true, but I've heard it said that in the Jewish tradition, the Torah, the sacred scripture there, the Torah, is regarded as black fire written on white fire. That the characters, the words, are black fire, and they're written on white fire, the paper, you know, the papyrus, the parchment, and that you have to study for years to learn what the black fire is. And you have to study for many, many, many more years to understand the white fire. And I'm like, oh, that just sounds like Zen. That's a transmission outside the scriptures, far beyond words and letters. So the page on which it's written is of equal dharma as the words themselves. So I think when we sit with something long enough, it speaks to us. When we listen to people long enough, we kind of love them into opening. Blossoming, and we get to do that with our experience, and that's one of the invitations of Zen practice, is to be present to things in such a way that we listen and we love them into opening. so that we feel intimate, so that they feel intimate with us. So, anyway, I discovered some, what I think is some nice Dharma here that I'll talk to you about, but poetry, of course, is intended for all of us, so you'll probably see many, many things here that I didn't see or didn't have time to spend on today. So I encourage you to hang this up on your fridge or tape it to your steering wheel. That's what I do with poems I like. I tape them to my steering wheel. I've been advised that's potentially unsafe depending on when I'm spending time with them, but anyway, you get the drift. Spend some time with this and see what it says to you. So the verse goes, if you have a program, it's on the front of the program, and if you don't, I'll read it for you. Rumi says, "We are the mirror as well as the face in it. We are tasting the taste this minute of eternity. We are pain and what cures pain. We are the sweet cold water and the jar that pours. We are the mirror as well as the face in it. We are tasting the taste this minute of eternity. We are pain and what cures pain. We are the sweet, cold water and the jar that pours." It's lovely. So here's what I found. We are the mirror as well as the face in it. So we have a long relationship with the mirror metaphor in Zen tradition. The mind is like a mirror, bright. Take care to brush it clean. And there's arguments for and against that in Zen, the metaphor. It's a great thing about metaphor. They like really, really work well until they don't. So we hold it lightly. It's a good metaphor. It's a good place to start. The place I'm going to take it instead is there's a lovely little passage in a book called The Wise Heart by Jack Kornfield. Some of you, I'm sure, know Jack Kornfield, a contemporary Buddhist teacher. And we used his book, The Wise Heart, for practice period some years ago. I forget how long ago. And one of the sections he talked about, he was talking about the nature of consciousness and the agelessness of consciousness, the literal timelessness of consciousness. And the experience he used to illustrate this, I'm assuming makes sense to everybody, he said that it's that experience you have of like all of a sudden looking yourself in the mirror and going, "Oh my God, how did that happen?" The person watching this reflection is still young, and the reflection in the mirror is old. What's going on? You know? And what he's pointing to, and I kind of like, it's just a metaphor for this, is that which beholds outside of the field of time. That part of you that is aware, and the part of you that beholds your reflection. Like, how come my reflection is now 20? How come it's now 30? Now wrinkles are developing. How come I'm now 40? How come I'm not? What's going on? That doesn't seem like me. Isn't that interesting? Because the thing that's watching doesn't know anything about this idea of time passing, right? And we can invent that. We can invent a logic around it by going, "Well, I remember last week. I remember when I was 5. Okay, now I'm going to create a timeline. I'm going to organize a nice finite thing that I can call my life so that the reflection in the mirror begins to make more sense to me." But what he was pointing to was consciousness itself, awareness itself, being outside of the field of time, and yet, of course, the face in it is us as well. We are the mirror. We are the beholder of the reflection. We are the face in the mirror. It's a lovely way of talking about non-dual awareness, which is a fancy term. But all that really points to is when we're doing zazen, and we notice that we've begun to inhabit a narrative, or we've wandered, we're feeding an idea or a belief, and we release it, and we come back to just awareness, just we're temporarily going from what we think of as the field of time to the field of no time. And that initial moment of just before we label breath, in-breath, my in-breath, right? Before we own it, before we inject ourselves, before there's a split, there's just one thing, non-dual. It just means not to. Non-dual awareness just means not to. Now, when we say in Zen, not one, not two, we don't want to get caught in emptiness and the oneness. We also don't want to get caught in the idea that separation's real, because it isn't. And they're both simultaneously true. Right? I think our heart understands this. We develop at least a spiritual intuition. This begins to resonate. We understand this. The head kind of less so gets it. But it's a valuable practice in the Zen tradition because it's one of the antidotes. Ben talked about this a few weeks ago. Ben talked about this a few weeks ago. It's one of the antidotes to delusion. It's one of the antidotes to delusion. One of the primary sources of suffering is our belief in our fundamental separateness, right? Our fundamental two-ness. And when we touch the experience of not two-ness, we begin to see through that. You know, two-ness has its function. It has its place. There's a usefulness to my regarding myself as a separate being, but it also doesn't represent a fundamental assertion about reality, and a lot of suffering comes from my belief in separateness. I need to protect now. I need to take care of now. Right? Maybe at your expense, because I really believe that we're separate. So, that's kind of what this is pointing to. Yeah, we are the mirror. We are the face in it. So the teaching here is just about not getting stuck. It's just about not getting stuck and getting trapped in the fundamental two-ness of things. He says, we are tasting the taste this minute of eternity. That's just a beautiful line. So eternity is not a measure of time. We normally think that it is. Oh, that meeting went on forever. It was an eternity. That's how we usually use the word to just refer to like an infinite amount of time. That meeting was infinitely long. It just never seemed to end. When I was a kid, the word eternity I always associated with church. It's about the only time I ever heard it. I also associated it with what happens after you die, because life in that model is finite. You're born, that's when you begin. You die, that's when this part of your existence ends, and that's finite. And if you're lucky, it's 90 years or something like that. But then after that is this thing called eternity, which does not end. And so I'm pretty invested for these however many years I have to make sure that the thing that happens after is good, because it's eternity. So it's like that meeting, but you want it to be a good meeting. It's like somebody brought donuts and everybody's getting along and it's eternity. So, ooh, sweet. So we usually think of it that way. Oh, it's a super long time. It doesn't end. Yes, yes. That isn't what the word really means. Eternity means without time, with no beginning, no end. No beginning, no end. So I get how it would take on the role socially of meaning no beginning, no end. Oh, it just went on forever. But if we look at that carefully, no beginning, no end only can mean now. We can't find the beginning of now. We can't find the end of now. Eternity is not a measure of time. It isn't it's fundamentally unmeasurable, right? Because measure means beginning and end. So when Rumi says, we are tasting the taste this minute of eternity, he's reminding us of the obvious. There is only one time you can taste it. This minute. It is the only time. It doesn't mean you're going to taste this same thing for a super long time. It will always taste like this. No. This is the taste of eternity. How else? What else could it possibly be? What else could it possibly be? The thing I like about this line is, for me, it has the emotional dimension of reminding me of the spaciousness of my experience. For me, when I'm caught by an afflictive pattern of thought or an afflictive emotion, it feels very constricted and tight. My world gets very small. There's just the anger, the sadness, whatever that thing is, right? It's afflictive, I don't like it, and it feels very, very narrow. The world gets kind of laser-like in its focus. It gets very tunnel vision-y. And I need to be reminded of the spaciousness of my experience. I need to be reminded of the spaciousness of my experience. And for some reason, and again, this is personal, I don't know if this works for everybody, but being told, like, this won't last, this is impermanent, that sort of helps, kinda. But you know how really bad afflictive emotions, even, you know, when you're in them and somebody says, well, this won't last forever, the emotion is telling you, oh yes, it will. You have always felt this way. You are feeling that way now. You will always feel this way, because it's timeless. It's the only moment you can taste. It's the only moment you can taste in that moment. So when somebody's grieving and you say, oh, someday, sweetie, you won't be. Yeah, that's true, but that's not an experience they can touch. Eternity is showing up for them as a broken heart. They're tasting the taste, that moment of eternity. So I like this wording because it doesn't deny my current reality. Do you know what I mean? It's not trying to talk me out of my experience. It's just reminding me the thing you're experiencing right now is just now, and there's no beginning and there's no end. This is it. This is eternity. You don't have to wait for the next thing to come around the corner. You don't have to compare it to the past experience. This is it. All my comparing mind is just sort of thrown out the window with that idea, right? This is it. There's no other moment to which to compare. Eternity. It's beautiful. Eternity is moment. Eternity is moment. I started noticing when I read a lot of the first generation of Japanese Zen teachers that brought Zen here. Some of them would say, come back to this moment, come back to this moment, come back to the moment. And some of them just said, come back to moment. And I thought, well, that's interesting. It wasn't their first language. You know, they're kind of clumsy with it. Or maybe the translator, da-da-da. And either one works. But I kind of decided I liked, even though it's a little awkward in English, I kind of liked come back to moment. Because, duh, this is extra. There isn't another moment. Right? And all those good first generation of cranky Zen teachers say, show me another moment. Just, if you really, really believe there's another moment, show it to me. Show me the moment you walked in the door today. It only happened like 5 minutes ago. Show it to me. Can you taste what you were tasting then? Can you hear what you were hearing then? No? How about the moment 5 minutes from now that you're so convinced exists? Give me one sound from that moment. Give me one taste from that moment. You can't. There is only, only, only moment. Eternity. It's kind of trippy, but it's cool. Don't you think that's trippy? I hope I'm not the only one who thinks that's trippy. So Dogen, in our tradition, because I want to tie this to Zen, of course. In our tradition, Dogen in the Genjo Koan has what I thought was a very, well, it still is mystifying, but I, at one point was utterly bamboozled by a little segment he has in there where he talks about firewood and ash. And he talks about, Dogen talks about, and his metaphor here is, we think of firewood as before, and it gets burned. Ash is after. Oh, okay, so this ash was once firewood, and this firewood will become ash. And he's really, really explicit and says, no, 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 no. Those are not true. Firewood is firewood. Ash is ash. He's kind of talking about the same thing. You're tasting the taste this moment of eternity. There is no other thing to compare it to. To think that there's a separate discrete thing called firewood that undergoes a process of transformation and becomes another thing is fundamentally untrue. There is this, and then there is this. That's all. And this really was hard for me to wrap my brain around. My brain still kind of doesn't get it. The other part of my awareness sometimes does get it, usually on about day 3 or day 4 of a long retreat. This is easier for me to kind of grab. Non-dual awareness is really what it is. But reality isn't divided into before and after. Reality isn't divided into firewood and then ash. There's just this thing. Hard for us to understand, but this type of awareness comes to us through Zen practice. This moment is not a continuation of a previous moment. This thing is not a continuation of a previous thing. This moment is not a precursor to the following moment. I gave a talk about a year and a half or 2 years ago about how caterpillars aren't like butterflies waiting to be. Oh, someday you'll be a butterfly. You'll be complete. You'll be beautiful. Ah, you're in your pre-butterfly stage. Nope. No, no, no. Complete, whole, perfect, done, now. Right? And the metaphor I used was like, when you were a fifth grader, were you just like a proto sixth grader? You were waiting to become. You weren't done yet. You weren't baked yet. You were waiting to have all the yeast rise so you could become complete. So right now, as a 28-year-old, you're waiting to become an actual person, which is what happens when you're 30. Oh, no, wait. No, it turns out it's 40. Oh, wait, it turns out when you retire, when you get married, when you find the right spouse, when you get, you know, right? So all this is all about come back to this, this, this. This isn't a pre-moment or a post-moment moment. Right? That's pretty cool. That's pretty cool. The invitation here is to freedom. That's actually the invitation. We see what the comparing mind does. So, that's what we're talking about here with eternity. Measuring change is what humans do. We invent something called time. That's super helpful. It is super useful. It is super useful. I know when I'm looking at that clock, I have a certain number of minutes left. I have to finish 3 more pages. I better hurry. There's a thing called time that's good for me to know about. I think the only time we get caught by it is when we reify it enough that we begin to think that the universe works that way. Our measuring of change is like, that's a real thing. Like, oh, I really, really believe there's a thing called an inch, you know, or a mile. Yeah, it's a useful fiction, but we get in trouble when we believe in it. So if there is only change, if there is only dynamic flow, moment is only moment, and it is immeasurable, and that's the point of the word eternity. That's the point of the word eternity. And what I like about what Rumi does, and like what I like about what Dogen does, is they refuse to let us that to let that be abstract for us. That they refuse to let us think of eternity as something separate than this body and this breath. I like that a lot. We are it. So, our next line becomes a little more practical. If it's been trippy up till now, don't worry. It's about to get very practical. He says, we are pain and what cures pain. I'm assuming that's a lot closer to home for most of us experientially. I don't normally go home and report to my wife, oh, I had the taste of eternity today. I just don't normally say that. But it is a lot more normal for me to go, oh, I had a really miserable morning. I experienced pain today. Oh, yeah. Sounds like the story of every single day, right? Pretty human. We are pain and what cures pain. So this is a fantastic, this is like the Cliff's Notes version of the Four Noble Truths. That's all it is like, the Buddha just went on and on and on. Oh, there's four things. There's always a list. Yeah, well, Rumi just says, you are pain and what cures pain. I'm making fun of Shakyamuni-san. We are pain and what cures pain. This is the Four Noble Truths. The Four Noble Truths, the universality of suffering, the cause of suffering within the mind with its grasping, with its wanting things to be different. The possibility of freedom from suffering, the Third Noble Truth is, there is an end to suffering. And then the Fourth Noble Truth, outlining what that is. Wisdom, ethics, meditation, right? That's exactly what he's saying. Like, pain is born here. You are that. You're the one making it, and you get to cure it. Cool, right? That's fantastic news. It's terrible news. I know. It's both those things. The responsibility is yours. Yay! Oh, the responsibility is yours. Oh. But there it is. There is no horse to ride into paradise in Buddhism. You are the horse. So, we are pain, and we are what cures pain. And I'll be brief on this because this is our thing here. This is what we talk about all the time. This is what we talk about all the time. It's interesting that he follows the eternity line with this because, you know, one of the convenient ways of summing up the origin of suffering, we especially talk about it this way, it seems, in Zen, is wishing things to be otherwise. Wishing things to be otherwise. It's not the traffic jam that hurts you. It's the fact you don't want it to be a traffic jam that hurts you. Right? There's no implicit power in a line of cars that causes you suffering. It's just the fact you want it to be different. That's where the suffering is. You know, it's always, I want reality to show up different than it is. I want reality to show up different than it is. It's not reality. It's I want it to be different. So when he says you're tasting the taste this moment of eternity, we are pain and what cures pain. Isn't that interesting to tie those two together? This is the moment where the pain arises. This is eternity. This is the moment the pain ceases. This is eternity. What I like about this, when I link those two together, is I still, after all these years of doing this, I still think the less pain thing, the enlightenment thing, the fuller understanding thing, the maturity thing, I don't know what I want to call it, is just around the corner. Maybe it's 3 more years of good practice or 10 more years of good practice. I thought maybe it would happen when the robe turned brown. Oh, yes. No, I'm just as talented at causing myself massive amounts of suffering as I was. Wow. Wow. The moment in which to do this is now. And the cool thing about linking the idea of eternity with what cures pain is, when I release my grip, my death grip on suffering, on the narrative, on the belief, on the pattern, on the whatever that thing is that has caused me so much anguish, and I experience a moment of freedom, is that not eternity? That is the only moment I know. That is the only moment I can touch, feel, taste. It is the only moment I've ever inhabited, and it's totally free. Wow, that's pretty cool. That's pretty cool. So, In Buddhism and in Zen, of course, we are always encouraged. This is the promise of practice. When we recognize we cause our own suffering, we are given the tools, we have the awareness with which to stop doing that, to change those patterns, to give rise to something other than suffering. So please, sit down. Please find this for yourself. And there's actually no other place to look than in yourself here right now. There's no other place. It's never outside, it's never before, it's never after. It's always in you now. So, something a little more comforting for me in our last line. We are the sweet cold water and the jar that pours. I like that he ends here. He oftentimes ends with an up. I like that. If your movie is like really, really deep and really profound and full of great imagery and an end sad, I don't like it. Hats off to you, you made a good movie, I just don't want to watch it ever again. If it's sort of shallow, sort of stupid, but it ends really great, I'm on board. I want that movie. I'm a Kung Fu Panda kind of guy, not a... That's what I want. That's what I want. So, yeah, actually, if you've seen Kung Fu Panda, you are the mirror in the face, and it sort of works. When he gets to the dragon scroll and opens the dragon scroll, it has enlightenment and it's empty. Spoilers. Pretty cool. I figure it's been out for 5 years. If you haven't seen it, white fire. There's nothing on the scroll but white fire, you guys. It's a very deep, that's another talk for another day. Very deep film. Anyway, all right. Oh, I derail myself so easily. We are the sweet cold water. So this is beautiful. This is, of course, giving us, again, the awareness, reminding us the awareness of our profound capacity to ease suffering in self and other. We have such an amazing power to relieve suffering, every single one of us. It is amazing. We normally try to hold this at arm's length, the idea of knowing I can actually be that powerful and effective at relieving suffering of self and others is a little bit overwhelming for us, frankly, because it comes with the idea that now it's my responsibility to do it. Sorry. It's true. We all have unbelievable capacity to change lives, starting with our own. It's unbelievable. And we all know this because we can think of at least a half a dozen people in every single one of our heads, off the top of our heads, people who absolutely changed either your life personally or the life of this country or the life of this world because of how they live their life. All right? The reason we try to distance ourselves from it and the way we distance ourselves from it is that they are special, remarkable people, and I am not them. We're right back to separation again. We're right in it, right? No, Buddha wasn't remarkable. Martin Luther King, Buddha, Gandhi, Mother Teresa, Harriet Tubman, these are people. They're people. And they suffered, and they ached, and they saw something, and they helped themselves, and they helped others. And we do it all the time. We actually do it every single day in little ways. And the invitation is to increase your awareness. Do you see how you just did that? You saw she had 2 bags of groceries, and you stayed in that spot for 5 seconds longer than you needed to hold the door. That's all. You're not special. You got 2 arms and 2 legs. But you saw it because you're paying attention. You saw it. You saw, oh, I can make a difference right here. And maybe you didn't even have that sentence. And if you didn't have that sentence, good for you. It came up from your cells. This is what people do. Science is showing us this now. And I know we live in a culture where kind of science is the shared religion. I know we don't talk about it that way. But, I sort of believe it. Oh, the studies show that. Oh, yeah. Now, oh, yeah, vitamin D here. Compassion or mindfulness, or it was like, yeah, once science says it's okay, now we can talk about it openly. Okay, okay, good. Whew. Coming out of the closet. But science is showing, and this is cool, that compassion is actually the first response. Compassion's hardwired. We're hardwired for cooperation. We are hardwired for compassion. On a cellular DNA, I don't know what science stuff is, but at the basis possible level, we are wired to understand your suffering is my suffering, helping you helps me. We get that. We act from a very different place a lot of the time. I understand that too. I am not in any way denying that. But when you are with a loved one who is in pain, and they're eased or they're comforted by your presence, what is it that actually makes them feel better is my question. Is it what you're doing for them? You made them a hot dish. You cleaned their floor. I don't know, you helped fix the gutters in their house. Is it what you said? Did you say something kind? Did you say something smart? Tell a joke? You had really good advice for them, maybe? Or was it just you? Just you, that you were there? Is it all the above? I don't know. We are the water, we are the jar. If I'm with you and I help you, is it the thing that I did, or is it me? I do not know. He's saying it doesn't matter. They're one thing. They're one thing. We all know also, we've all had experiences of being helped by someone else's presence. They didn't solve the problem, give advice, fix the gutters, come with a hot dish. They were just there, and we felt better. Is that a magic trick that everybody knows how to do? I guess. Isn't it interesting that everybody gets to do that magic trick? So the metaphor he's using here is that we're all thirsty. We're right back to the first noble truth again. We're all thirsty. And he's saying, you get to be the container for the water, and you get to be the water. When somebody's sick, you get to be the medicine and the container for the medicine. He's not prescriptive. He's not telling which to do. He's just reminding you there's only one thing happening here. And it doesn't have to always feel relational. When you're alone, this is Zen practice too. When you're alone and you're in pain, emotional pain, physical pain, mental anguish, how you care for yourself, how in that moment can you show up as the water or the medicine? And of course, we encounter this all the time. We're oftentimes alone, physically, emotionally, whatever. And of course, we're in pain a lot because, duh, that's the universal human condition a lot of the time. So what we actually do, like let's say you skin your knee. You're on your way into the Zen Center and it's icy outside and you fall and you hurt your knee, you skin your knee. So the first thing that happens is you have an experience of pain, you notice it. It arises in the field of your consciousness. Ouch, you're in pain. You see that you have been hurt. You see that you have been hurt. What do you need? You figure, okay, well, the skin's been broken. I'm bleeding a little bit. I better clean that out. I better bandage it. And you do. You take care of yourself that way. This is common sense. We don't usually even have the thoughts, oh, I have been wounded. Oh, I need to clean this out. Oh, I need to go get a Band-Aid. You just do it. You just take care of yourself. You just go get the Band-Aid because it's what you do. And when you're cleaning out your wound, you do it very gently. You do it very carefully. And you put on the antibacterial cream there, and you put the Band-Aid on, and you feel a little bit better, caring for yourself. And in that moment of noticing, oh, I feel better, am I feeling better? Are you feeling better because of the cleaning of that wound? Are you feeling better because of the cream? Are you feeling better because of the bandage? Are you feeling better because of the soft quality of your awareness when you were caring for yourself? Do you feel better because you were just really gentle with yourself when you were wounded? All of those things. This is Zazen. This is Zazen. It has the quality, Zazen has the quality of being soft and constant and careful. And our heart mind regards what arises with kindness. I see you. Hello, bored. Hello, knee pain. Oh, hello, peace. Hello, feeling of equanimity that's now turning into anxiety, strangely. Oh, hello, sadness that has a little bit of joy. That's weird. I'm regarding all of these things with acceptance and some kindness. That type of awareness that we cultivate, that constancy, gentle, slow, kind, we're just reminding ourselves about the nature of awareness itself. Awareness is kind. Awareness has a quality to me of kindness to it. To pay attention to something is to offer it something. So Suzuki said when he was, and I forget where this is from, but they were talking about, you know, when you're new to Zazen, you're sometimes given the instruction to count the breaths. Sometimes you're just given the instruction to just be aware of the breath. Anyway, they usually tie body and breath awareness in at the beginning of Zazen training. It's a fabulous place to start. And Suzuki said, just to observe the breath is to help take care of it. That's an interesting line. What's implied there is to pay attention to something is to start taking care of it. First, I must notice it. And if that noticing is a, no, 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 you don't belong, you're out, there's no kindness there. Right? There's no kindness there. But if that noticing is, I see that you're here. I see that you're here. That initial contact with experience is a yes. Right? It's not a condoning or an endorsing or a feeding, because when greed shows up, anger shows up, right? I get that you're here. I'm going to give you tea to be polite, but I'm not going to feed you or you'll stay. Tea is polite. Food is stay. So be kind. Be kind. And Rumi says we are the medicine and the vessel. And I'm going to wax abstract here for just a minute on the metaphor of water, and then I'm going to wrap up, because it's interesting that he says water. Of course, he lived in the Middle East, and it's super, super hot, and going to the well is a big deal. Pretty easy metaphor. I'll admit my relationship with water is pretty much I take it for granted because it's always there. It's at several places in my house whenever I want it. I can even choose the temperature. Isn't that cool? But I rarely sit down and have a glass of water because it's boring. I'd rather have, and I can give you a long list of things I'd rather have. But water's a wonderful metaphor. The reason it's a wonderful metaphor in my eyes is that it's nothing special. It is the most ordinary possible thing we can drink, the most common liquid there is. It's what you're made of. It's what our planet is made of. It is just the ordinary, boring world. The most ordinary thing. I also like this because we all know what thirst tastes like. Does that make sense? What thirst shows up as? We can say what it feels like. We can say the thoughts that come with it. But thirst, there's something very, very deep about that. If my body is 75% water and I don't have enough water, that's a massively big problem. You're like, you're made of this and you're running out of it. That means you're going to die. So naturally, all of my systems go, you know, on red alert. And thirst is an acute human experience that everybody understands. And when we're really, really, really thirsty and we drink a glass of water, it's an unbelievable experience. Isn't it? You've just been given exactly what you needed. Nothing extra, nothing less. It's an unbelievable experience. Just water. When we experience thirst, the body is saying, I need water. I need water. That's what the body is saying. What it's not saying is, I need Kool-Aid. I need beer. I need pop. I need wine. Or, forgive me, tea. It's not saying, I need tea. I love tea, you guys. It's my deal. It's just saying I want water. Right? Water comes in all those things. Wonderful. But if someone is thirsty, is giving them pop caring for them? I'm not answering that question. I don't know. Maybe it is sometimes. Maybe sometimes it isn't. What this is about is recognizing what's actually needed. What's actually needed. You are the sweet, cold water. You are the jar that pours it. There's an invitation here to be just the thing. Just the thing. You don't need to do the extra. I was lucky enough, and maybe I have just enough time to tell this story. I was lucky enough a couple years ago, last year and then the year before, to go to South Africa and help lead a pilgrimage and a retreat there. And one of the things we had all the retreatants do before we left for Africa was there's a charity called the Water Project in Africa, and it's a wonderful charity. All they really want you to do is gather funds to help dig wells in rural villages. People have to walk for miles and miles to get water, so they're just gathering money to dig wells. Very, very simple. Their invitation, the way they've packaged this to those of us in the West who are affluent, is for 2 weeks, take the Water Project Challenge. For 2 weeks, drink only water. Just drink water. And at the end of the 2 weeks, please take all the money you would have spent on your double high mocha caramel latte or whatever it is, or your pop or your beer or your wine or your whatever, and just take that money and give that to us. Cool, right? I'm not saying go thirsty, don't drink anything for 2 weeks. You're just saying just get rid of anything that's a luxury drink, which is anything that's not water. So I thought, well, because I'm helping to lead this thing, I probably should be a good example and actually do it. So I did it. And it was fantastic spiritual practice. The entitlement that came up right away I deserve latte. I didn't know I deserved latte, but as soon as you took it away from me for 2 days, I got cranky and I got pissed and my head started to hurt, and all of a sudden it's like, well, I can at least have, well, surely they don't mean all day. Maybe right before I go to bed. I started negotiating. I mean, I went through essentially the stages of grief. Anger, bargaining, despair, right? Wow, just after being, you know, and so the funny part about the experiment was, for 2 weeks you can have all the water you want, the thing your body actually wants, the thing you're made of, the thing the planet's made. I'm not being deprived of anything that I need. I'm just being deprived of a lot of things I want. No toys. Starts seeming like a session, starts seeming like zazen, right? No toys here. So this was a fascinating experiment, and when I got together with those folks in Africa and we started talking about our experience, everybody relayed variations on the same theme. I thought I deserved it. I tried to talk my way into it. I rationalized it. I started cheating on day four. Da, 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 da. It's wonderful. It's wonderful. The invitation here, and the only reason that I bring that in is because what I learned after the end of 2 weeks was, I don't need tea. I love tea. I had tea this morning. As soon as we're done talking here, I'm going to go have more tea. But tea shows up in my glass in a different way. No. I understand it's a luxury. I don't need it. I understand that there's a level of appreciation I feel for it that I didn't, because I chose to not have it. And I really appreciate that inside the tea, underneath the tea, all around the tea is water. Water. Right? It's water. That's what I'm craving. That's what I'm thirsty for. I am the sweet cold water. I am the jar that pours, just like you are. When you offer your presence to somebody, when you devote your practice to somebody, even if that somebody is yourself, you get to be both those things. You get to be exactly what the world needs. Exactly what the world needs. So I'm going to wrap up here. The reason I just want to talk with you folks today about this little verse is that I dearly trust it. I have a lot of trust in Rumi's voice, and in particular some poems that I've spent a lot of time with. I really trust that this is true. I trust these words to be true, and I have long since memorized this, and I kind of carry it with me like an old friend. And this is a friend who is kind enough to me and is brave enough to tell me the truth. I really aspire to be that kind of friend to other people. Giving me pop is nice, but if all I need is water, maybe you're a better friend if you actually just give me that. There's something true about that. So, I don't think we need to quest painfully outside of ourselves to end our suffering. You know, we never get to find the end of our suffering in the right job or the right relationship or the right climate or the food or the drug or the hobby or even the religion. And we need to be reminded of that. And this great eternity that we all fear or that we all long for is just this. It's so close. I need to be reminded of that. The whole of reality not holding itself back from me, ever. Not hiding from me, ever. Not tricking me. Not making me wait, ever. And I trust that the truth is not concealed. And I trust that when he says, eternity includes me, I'm the water. I trust that that's true. And I believe it sometimes more than others. But that's why I offered it to you. I'm hoping that it's of some comfort or some inspiration or some help to you. So please continue your practice. Please continue to offer yourself to the suffering world. It does so need you. Thank you very much. And we do have some time. Not long, I'm afraid. I rambled a bit, but maybe 5 minutes or so if anybody has a question, a comment, observation, something they'd like to share. Stephanie, please.
The trouble with the progression of change in, you know, as it manifests itself in, for instance, wood that might turn into ashes, that was pretty a great example for me too.
Oh.
And what I was wondering is this. Is that really talking about destiny?
Hmm. Say more about that.
Destiny is a sort of a anticipated, conceivably even prescribed sequence of events that will unfold themselves, sort of like a domino roll that's going to go down.
Mm-hmm.
But any given tree may not become ashes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so that's what I was wondering. Is it maybe about that?
Hmm.
Because if you burn a tree, it will be ashes.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really difficult for me not to believe.
Yeah, I'm with you. I'm with you, and I was, of course, linking those things. This is a before, and this is an after. Mm-hmm. Obviously makes sense. I never really linked it to the destiny idea. That's interesting. Some of you in this room probably know more about Buddhist scripture than I, so maybe you know. And to my awareness, we don't really talk much about something being predetermined or destined. The only thing that came to mind as you were talking was in the Dhammapada, and I'm just going to paraphrase because I forget, but the Buddha does talk about how the creation and the cessation of suffering carry with them a certain inevitability. When I continue to operate from greed, hate, and delusion, suffering will arise as surely as the shadow follows the ox cart or something. I forget the metaphor he uses. And the same thing with when I begin to release those things. Freedom, joy, compassion arise as surely as the sun will rise in the east or whatever. But that idea, like this, there, he even talks about them as almost being inevitable. When you continue to do this, then... And it's never prescribed that if you do that, this thing will happen. That's one of the relationships that Buddhism has with karma that's interesting, is it isn't, oh, because you have that, you must have done this. If you do that, then that will happen. It's much more when you continue to operate out of fear and anger keep happening. Mm-hmm. When you keep planting seeds of hate, hate keeps growing. In Kung Fu Panda, it's, you know, only a peach tree can come from a peach seed. I'm telling you guys. Anyway, so I'm not sure if that's pointing to what, because in a sense, like, yes, if I start a fire and put a log in it.
There's cause and effect.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's, you know, probably the lowest level. But I don't think that's what the poem is about.
Mm-hmm.
It's not trying to say, well, we'll have trouble with cause and effect. I don't think so.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea that something, that, you know, there's no gain in anything, there's no possibility in anything, that it would be a destiny. I think, mm-hmm. to me, it seemed like it was addressing that.
That's interesting. Did anybody else get a destiny thing out of that? Bill?
I read some interpretations of this line from the Genjo Koan, and they're all very trippy.
Oh, the firewood ash line, yes.
But I think you could maybe think of it as destiny, but in an achronological way, or in an eternal way. So the ash was always ash. It's never firewood, but all the conditions that would lead to the firewood becoming ash would totally collapse into that moment. So it's kind of acknowledging all the conditions that are embodied in the ash or the firewood, but it's not like an A, B, C, D thing like that.
Mm-hmm. That's another angle.
It is. It's fascinating. And I actually sat with that for a long, long time before it even began to. Mm-hmm. It was much more of an intuitive leap, I almost think, because my brain couldn't quite. You know. Please.
Two things. First of all, I want to share the experience of listening to this talk and other talks that I've heard from you, and I wonder if other people have experienced them similarly, which is that you set a destination at the beginning. I'm looking forward to that destination. On your way, you drop like 5 or 10 truth bombs that totally blow up my mind. Like,
oh.
It's a good experience.
Sorry about that.
It's sort of like fall out of your sleeves. You're not even watching it. But the second thing is, when I first started sitting down, I took comfort in the fact that if I didn't scratch my ear when it itched, that the itch would pass.
Yeah.
And so then I started to think about other kinds of pain that way. When I was sitting with them, I was sort of going like, well, this hurts, but like the itch, it will pass.
Mm-hmm.
And now I'm realizing that I was anticipating the moment when the pain would pass.
Yeah.
And so I think I'm going to have to start to find comfort from the book.
Yeah. That's a great example, actually, of exactly what we're talking about. And try not to turn it into a good, bad thing, because there is honest to God comfort in knowing this will pass. This will pass. That's really, really important to know will pass. And you know that it's true. You've never had a feeling that didn't leave, ever. But you're right. At the same time, it's a very subtle, that's cool that you've noticed that. you start realizing, oh, actually part of my comfort right now is I'm going away from my current experience by imagining a future in which, you know, when the firewood becomes ash, then. And, oh, that's actually removing me from my experience. Does that make sense to people? Did you hear what he said? Yeah. Isn't that cool? Thank you. That's really a helpful example, I think. Yeah. Let me answer your question on the porch afterwards. I've got to turn this over to Peter because he's mad with power. He's a Don, and we've got to do announcements. I'm sorry. Thank you.